welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report. We got just a stellar guest coming up, G. Edward Griffin. You know him. You know this book, right? You know this book. This is like the Bible on our money, for our money supply. This is the resource right here. And for those listening on Global Star Radio Network and BTR, I'm holding The Creature from Jekyll Island, authored by G. Edward Griffin. I never tire of hearing this man talk. I never tire of hearing this man give his analysis on various issues, including that of money. A second look at the Federal Reserve. This is the subtitle of this book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. If you don't have this on your bookshelf, you're missing out. And if you haven't read it, not just on your bookshelf, but if you haven't read it, you're missing out. Mr. Griffin's going to be joining us shortly. Before we do, speaking of books, let me tell you something. T.C. Joseph has done this amazing job in writing some novels for entertainment. It's something I call faction. This generation series of novels in this thrilling three-part series of novels. T.C. Joseph takes us into the lives of three families in this world where conspiracy theories and Bible prophecies collide. Folks, go to thisgenerationseries.com and check out his books. Book one is Precipice, book two is Pentecost, and book three is Penance. And I have to say this, I love the way he writes. I love the character development. Kirkus and Blue Ink both give him high marks on his writing. We use them here, and I have used all three books on a friend who really doesn't care to read about fact. So if they want to read fiction, they want to read novels, this will serve to wake up that family member, friend, or neighbor. So T.C. Joseph, This Generation Series of Novels, thisgenerationseries.com. Now, as I mentioned, G. Edward Griffin, you all know him. He really needs little introduction. He is the man, the foremost authority, I believe, and most respected when it comes to The Creature from Jekyll Island, which is the title of his book, A Creature Indeed. Mr. Griffin, welcome to the Hagman, and welcome back to the Hagman Hagman Report, sir.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to see you as well. Now, you're going to be at the Red Pill Expo coming up, I believe, right?
Oh, yes, indeed. That's one of the major events of my life, really, and that's not hype either. It's the biggest event we've ever tried to put on, and not only big in size, but big in scope, and I'm definitely going to be there.
I love it. Okay. And that's, let's see, that is 28 days from now. That's going to be on the 23rd through the
23rd and the 24th, okay. Yeah.
In Bozeman, Montana, no less.
Yeah. Everybody wants to know why Bozeman.
Do you have an answer?
I do, actually, yes. The first thing that attracted our attention was that they had great facilities there. I mean, great convention and conference facilities for a small town, but then it's a large university town, so that made sense. And then we found out it's an international airport. Well, God, what's going on in Bozeman? And then it's beautiful country. And then we noticed that the prices for everything were less than in the usual conference centers. And then finally we said, who in the heck wants to go to Las Vegas again? Especially if you're a bunch of truth seekers, you know. Why go to Las Vegas where everything is false? all added up.
I got to tell you, it's a good choice. Both Joe and I were in Bozeman a couple of years ago. It's a beautiful, beautiful area, and good choice on the location.
Yeah.
So that's great. And that's, again, folks, June 23rd through 24th. I would go just to hear G. Edward Griffin. I would travel to, you know, on Burrow back to listen to this man in person, to meet him in person. So, Red Pill Expo, really hot on that. Again, June 23rd and 24th. All right. Well, we certainly don't have, we certainly have a lot to talk about, Mr. Griffin. There's no shortage of things to talk about. However, if you don't mind, can you give people just an overview? Those people, maybe there are still some people who really don't get the picture. Kind of give us an overview about the biggest bank robbery in history.
The biggest bank robbery in history. Boy, that sounds like a cue if I ever heard one. Especially since I've written about that. Most folks call it the Federal Reserve System. And it is the biggest bank robbery, the biggest fraud, the biggest scam, I suppose, in all history. So what can I say about the Federal Reserve that people really want to hear? That's the question. People don't want to hear about the Federal Reserve because they think, as I used to think at one time before I got into this, that all that banking stuff, it's technical terms. Who cares about discount rates and all the long words that they use to describe the various transactions? Who cares about that? As long as, I get my paycheck and I can buy things at the store and the prices are reasonable. I'm sure there are good people in the government taking care of all this for us, right? Well, that was my attitude then. And then I found out as I got into it, like so many illusions that we'll be talking about at the Red Pill Expo, which is all about seeing through illusions and facing reality. Like so many illusions, that was one of the biggest ones, and that is that the money system is not being taken care of by an agency of the federal government at all. It's being managed by a very, very private and powerful group. Actually, the group is a cartel. It's not a government agency at all. It goes to great lengths to look like a government agency. It uses the word federal in it and everything, and Federal Reserve. Well, it's not federal any more than Federal Express. It has no reserves to speak of. They call themselves a bank. It's not really a bank. It's a cartel of banks. So all the way from top to bottom, it's an illusion. And why should people care? Well, they should care because in the middle of almost every human transaction in the world today, there's this thing called money. In the old days, in the very old days, if you wanted to have something that you did not make and you wanted to purchase it, you had no choice but to either work for it with your labor or swap something that you had already acquired or made yourself for that. That's called barter. Well, the invention of money, of course, was the big spring that allowed the economy to unwind and people to accomplish things and build a lifestyle and all of the advantages that we enjoy is this money, the ability to exchange something other than the object you want to use. And so you look it up in the dictionary, you find out this, the definition of money is a medium of exchange. And that tells you everything that really you need to know about money. It's a medium that you can use to swap one thing for another, and that you can hang on. You can acquire that medium and stash it away someplace so you have a little reserve, like you dammed up the water in the stream and you don't need to use it or let it all go through. You can save some of it and use it for later purchases. Well, now, if you imagine that money as a medium of exchange is in the middle, as it suggests, in the middle of almost every human exchange in the world, and that thing called money is manufactured by a private group of individuals with absolutely zero oversight, with absolutely zero political control over it, it's a mind-boggling thing, because all they have to do is just carve out a little percent or half a percent or a quarter of a percent of every human transaction, and you can imagine what a wide river of gold that is, that flows into the private coffers of the people who can create money as they do. So it's a mind-boggling thing. Everything we do, we pay a little tribute to these people who control the money supply. And I'm here to repeat that it's not done by the government. It's done by a private group of banks. It's a group of competing banks or partially competing banks that came together back in 1910, and by 1913 they worked out the plan not to compete anymore, to form a cartel, sort of a monopoly among certain major competitors. They said, look, why should we compete and batter each other to the ground with blood all over the battlefield in Paris, New York, and Wall Street and so forth, competing with each other on interest rates and finding clients? Why don't we just all get together and divide up the markets, and that way we can get higher profit margins without competition? And that's what they did. That was happening not just in banking, but all across all aspects of industry at the turn of the last century. So that's what happened. I'm taking too long perhaps to explain it, but I'm trying to emphasize the fact that every slice of every transaction we make with another human being, economically that is, a slice of that is going to these hidden manipulators that we had never dreamed even existed. And the little bite they take for their service In some cases, it's not really a service, but in many cases, it is. But the bite they take is exorbitant because there's no competition allowed. So half of our purchasing power, every generation or every two generations, half of our purchasing power is being consumed by this group. If you had a dollar at the time the Federal Reserve was created in 1913, today the purchasing power of that dollar in terms of what it could purchase in 1913 is less than 3 cents. Where did the other 97 cents go from your savings? It went to this cabal. It went to this group of bankers who went in partnership with the politicians. It's a very secret, very complex thing, but that's where that money went. In other words, it's legalized plunder. It is the biggest bank robbery of all history.
It's a marvelous explanation, and I think people need to really understand this, Joe. This is at the crux of everything. It's money. It's all about money, and it's all about who controls the money.
Absolutely, and then the question is where does it go from here? You know, you talked about how the value of the dollar from 1913 till now has lost 97 to 98% of its value with that little percentage that is left, you know, with these international banking systems we see from, the IMF, the World Bank. Where does the Federal Reserve go from here? Has it plundered all the money that it plans on taking, or is there another end goal that it has in mind after it removes the rest of the value from the U.S. dollar?
Well, the answer to that is controversial. Different people have different answers to it, but since you asked me, I'll give you my answer to it. The way I see it is that no, they haven't reached the end, because we still have an economy. People still have savings, although it's dwindling constantly. People still have homes, automobiles. They own things, although it's getting harder and harder and harder to do that. They still have a lot of private ownership out there. And these people want it all. I mean that literally. They want it all. They're not content until they get all of it. Now, it's a hard concept to accept. There's a tendency to say, I don't believe that. Why would they want it all when they've got so much of it? Well, that's just the way it is. I think it was Rockefeller himself. Somebody asked him how much money is enough, and he said, I'll let you know, or something like that. And it's never enough, because it's not just the money. You see, the money is the path to power. It's the path to control. What money really, its only value, since you can't eat it, its only value is in terms of what you can acquire with it. And its value is that you use it to retain the products and services of other people. Now, in the old days, that was, if you had the right to claim all of the products and services of a person, then that person was your slave. That was called servitude. And that slavery still hasn't disappeared from the world. But in the old-fashioned form, it's pretty rare. Yeah, there are still slaves in parts of the world. It's quite common. But in the Western world, it's frowned upon to think that there would be such a thing as slavery. Well, if all of your output, all of your goods and services really flow to someone else, whether you like it or not, then you may not realize it or not, but you are literally a slave to that person. Now, as it turns out now, most of us are partial slaves. You know, at what point in the year do we stop working for taxes and interest rates, taxes to the government and interest rates to the banks? Well, it's somewhere between May and June. In other words, half of our lives are now spent serving other people that we don't even know their names. We don't know how it happens, but we are right now half enslaved and don't even know it. They want the other half. They want to go back to the good old days of the Roman Empire. They want to go back to the days when there were the slaves and then the masters, and everybody understood which side they were on. It was very simple. And if you were the master, that's the way you wanted to keep it. That's the answer. They want it all, because it's not the money. They want the total control over the population. So where is this headed is the question. That's where they would like to see it go. And if we don't stop it, that is where it's going. And it's not going to happen, in my view, through the money, believe it or not. I think the money is what gets us to the front door. But there will come a point when the currencies, it's already happened in many cases, the currencies collapse. They don't buy anything anymore. and they can say, well, we got a new currency. Let's go to a new currency. Let's back this one a little bit with gold. Everybody says, oh, good, we got it backed by gold. This one will be a good currency. Then 10 years later, they take the backing away, and it's gone right back to the same old fiat currencies we've always had, and then that currency collapses. And then the powers that be say, well, we've got a new currency now. And they keep replacing older, defunct currencies with newer currencies, which are also fiat, meaning they're not backed by anything except the political power to create them out of nothing and to force people to accept them. And so you go through this period of collapse of one currency, one system after another. Where does that go? Well, it doesn't take, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that when the money of the world is finally combined into one currency, and that's what they are working toward, a universal, international, one world currency, and then when that one collapses, there's no place else to go. At that point, everyone, except that very small oligarchy at the top, everyone else will be dependent upon the state for food, shelter, employment, education, everything. Now, at that point, you don't need money. All you need is just little numbers or digits or a different colored card that'll get you into a better restaurant. And you get assignments from the state of where you're going to live. And you get coupons for clothes you wear. You get maybe we're talking about that chip that's going to be buried in your hand. And if you're a good boy and girl and you play by the rules and you don't cause any trouble, well, you hold that chip up against the scanner. Oh, you can buy groceries with it. But if you're a troublemaker like I am, you hold that chip up and it's no money, nothing. You can't buy anything. That's where we're headed, and that is will be the new definition of slavery. It'll be economic slavery, and it will not necessarily involve money at all, but digitized units, which is another form of money, of course.
Okay. Digitized units. All right. I'm going to ask you the big question.
I didn't really complete that because, in a sense, what we already have is that. I mean, we're using credit cards, right? And we're using checks, checkbook money. And those are digitized units. They don't represent anything of value. So we already have that system. But with the present system, if you get hold of some pieces of paper called $20 bills or $100 bills, you can stash them away and you can exchange them and everything. You can hide them. And you can have transactions that the oligarchy doesn't know about, so you still have some means of survival. But when it's all digitized and you can't hang on to it, and it's all in the banks and all in the computers, you just don't get hold of it. Now that's total control.
Okay, and I get that. All right. As we are still allowed to have folding paper in our wallets and our pockets underneath our mattress, we still have that semblance, however twisted and convoluted that is, but that semblance of freedom, shall we say, right? Is that what you're saying as well?
Yes, we have a certain independence. I guess freedom and independence have an overlap in definition. But as long as we have the economic power to purchase food and shelter and to travel someplace, we have a certain independence. If we're completely dependent for everything, including a drink of water, on a digit of some kind that's issued to us by an authority that is very concerned about what we think, that's a whole different ballgame.
Mr. Griffin, we identified the Federal Reserve, how it has nothing to do with the government, and we see, as we mentioned earlier, you know, the international institutions of finance that have been popping up. We know who controls the Federal Reserve, as you laid out, and as you laid out in your book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, and these oligarchs who are total control. Do these same people control the international banking system?
Yes, I think that's a pretty fair statement. I'm sure there are some exceptions or some specialty categories, but in general, I think that's an accurate statement. All the power eventually comes back to control of money systems and the wealth of the world. And, you know, it's not hard to see that. I mean, it was Rothschild back in the early days before the Federal Reserve was created, who is quoted as saying, it could never be confirmed, but it sounds like he probably did say it, and he's attributed it having said, I care not who makes the laws so long as I can create the money. Now, there you have it. You see, if you can create the money, you can buy those people who make the laws. They're for sale in many cases. And so those who control the money actually indirectly control the governments of the world and everything, the political systems, the educational system. With money, you can literally buy almost everything you need for total dominance.
Father's Day is coming up, folks, and I'm 90% sure, 99% sure, actually, my wife got this for me for last Father's Day. My wife and daughter, Jackie. This is one of the best investments you can make. The Creature from Jekyll Island by G.R. Griffin, who is our guest right now. He's going to be at the Red Pill Expo June 23rd and 24th. Folks, if you have no plans, well, cancel them and get to the Red Pill Expo. Joe, go ahead.
The website is redpillexpo.org. And we've had people on, like Patrick Wood, Ty Bollinger will be on in, next month as well. Who are going to be at this conference. Again, go to redpillexpo.org and check out all the information there. Who's going to be speaking, how to get your tickets, where it's going to be held. It's going to be 28 days. You said June 23rd, I believe.
Yeah, 28 days from now.
Yeah.
In 9 hours.
So check that out in beautiful Bozeman, Montana. And we know, Mr. Griffin, we went to maybe four years ago. We actually got an opportunity to go to Bozeman, Montana for a conference. We flew in at night. And I've never been out west, never been to Montana. So woke up in the morning in the hotel, went to go get coffee, step outside the hotel room, and all of a sudden we're surrounded by the beautiful Rocky Mountains.
Oh, that's great.
And that's something I'll never forget. That's a beautiful place up there, folks. If you get an opportunity to go, go. And Mr. Griffin, we have just a few minutes, about 3 minutes before our break. Want to kind of continue with the international banking system. We know, the world economy is kind of broken down by, you have the West, then you have Europe, and then you have Asia. And these are all still using the paper money source. And we see this influx of what you talked about, the digitization, the currencies moving to a more computerized centralization. Do you believe that the U.S. economy, as well as the international economy and banking systems, would it be easier for them to move to away from the paper currency at the same time, or do you believe it will be a more of a domino effect?
Well, I hadn't really thought about that. I do believe that in general these things seldom move abruptly. They move incrementally. There's one crisis after another, of course, very shocking and chaotic crisis that condition people to accept change and not cling to the old way because they're told that, well, it was the old way that caused the problem. I don't know, but I think that I know this much, that the plan for many decades has been to move from national currencies such as the U.S. dollar, the Japanese yen, the British pound, so forth, to move from those into regional currencies, like the euro, for example, which encompassed a lot of European national currencies. In North America, the plan has been to create something called the emiro. Now, a lot of people deny that that's the case, but that's absurd because the record is just loaded with government documents and meetings and conferences that have been held over the years where people from the United States, when I say people, I mean high-ranking people from the governments of the United States, Mexico, and Canada have come together and talked at great length and made plans at great length how to create a single currency for the North American continent called the emiro. And this has been going on in all the other regions of the world as well. So the movement has been steadily and slowly and almost invisibly in that direction following the original plan of moving from national currencies to regional currencies, and then later merge all of the regional currencies into an international currency. The reason for that strategy, as they have said in their own writings and their own speeches on this, is that it's very hard to acclimate the thinking of the people, to surrender their own national currencies. They have an affinity. They like to look at the money and see a picture of some national hero on it, you know. And, that's our guy, you know. And they say, that's our money. And there's this, it's like rooting for your own football team. And in order to get people to accept having somebody else's picture on their money, what they do is they keep the pictures there, but they start changing everything else, including the background that might show a global picture or something like that. And the idea is that they know that psychologically, to move the world's thinking toward an international currency, it's better to do it slowly so that there'll be no serious pushback. Now, having said all of that, and that's easily documented, having said all that, of late, some of these international meetings have been talking about the possibility of skipping that step and moving right directly toward an international currency to get on with it, mainly because they're worried about some kind of an international economic collapse that'll strike across all of national currencies. And they feel that it psychologically might be possible because of this great chaotic thing that they see looming, that people will be so frightened and so panicked that maybe they will be ready, after all, to make the jump from their national currencies to a true international currency all at one time, because they think that maybe that will be the salvation, and it'll be certainly worse than the economic collapse that looms. So,
Mr. Griffin,
here we are.
If you could hold that thought. I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're right at the break. We got a 3-minute break. We'll be right back after these short messages, folks. Our guest is G. Edward Griffin. He will be with us on the other side. Don't go anywhere.
Shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be.
Folks, I'm going to direct your attention to MasterPreps.com. MasterPreps.com. Wow. MasterPreps.com, the sponsor of our show, MasterPreps.com. That's MasterPreps.com. Take a visit there. High-quality items, made-in-America items. I mean, anything, everything you possibly want, from cooking utensils, cooking frying pans. It'll blow you away. Absolutely, Eric said.
It's insane. I mean, wow. Look at the products.
Folks, visit MasterPreps.com. Again, welcome to the Hagman & Hagman Report family. MasterPreps.com. I mean, wow. It's insane.
MasterPreps.com. Are you ready for what comes next?
Hi, I'm Grace Gonzalez from Chang Close in the Woods. We are an American family-owned company founded and built on skills and knowledge gained from responding to 18 major disasters in the U.S. and around the world. We found that most people don't have enough food and water to survive, let alone any medicinals to save their life. We're offering 25% off our must-have American Heritage Remedies Kit. It contains 12 homeopathic remedies, a booklet that goes over everything in your kit, and our brand new book, Major Disasters Lessons Learned. Just enter coupon code HAGMAN. In life or a disaster, you must be able to take care of yourself. You may not be a medical doctor, and your grandmother and your great-grandmother probably weren't either, but they still knew how to minister to their family's health issues, and so can you. Check out our American Heritage Remedies Kit at www.changelessonwoods.com. Your life may depend on it.
Hello, everyone. This is Joe Charles, the guy whose voice is heard announcing for the Hagman & Hagman Report right here on YouTube and across the Global Star Radio Network. There have been many people wondering whose music is being played during those breaks. Well, you guessed it. And we're very pleased to announce that all that music and 11 brand new songs from the CD New Jerusalem is set for release on April 10th for download on iTunes. That means you can help support my ministry and be blessed by this awesome, inspiring recording. I have been fortunate to work with some phenomenal musicians from around the world that helped us put this recording together in the studio. Simply go to joecharlesmusic.com and click on the iTunes link. Or, if you'd rather have a CD, we'll send one right out to you. Just leave me your email and we'll get right back to you. And thanks to Doug and Joe Hagman for making this all possible. God bless.
Our guest is G. Edward Griffin. He's the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island. It's a great book. I recommend this. I mean, this will wake everyone up. If you've got a neighbor, a friend, a family member who exhibits the least bit of interest into what's going on, this is a good foundational book, a good comprehensive book about really what is taking place and how we got to where we are, how we got here. Mr. Griffin really lays it out nicely. And Father's Day's coming up. Ladies, for the guy in your life, for the daughters and sons, for the father in your life, can I recommend this? I just did. Our guest is G. Edward Griffin. Before we get back to him, you know, the hurricane season starts the 1st of June. And this year is expected to be an active one in the Gulf and up and down the East Coast. As you make hurricane preparations for your family, think about what you'll do when the power goes out for a day, a week, a month. Who knows how long, right? What will you do when you can't charge your cell phone, listen to the radio, or find out what's going on? Well, having a lot of batteries is great until they go dead. We've had that happen, of course. A solar charger is nice to have as well. Yeah, between 10 and 3, right? What if it's a cloudy day? Or, hey, you know, what if it's nighttime? Well, remember that Greenovative has the G-Mag power cell that makes power anytime, anywhere, any weather, day or night, when you need it. Just add salt and water to the unit, and it's immediately charging your batteries. Make sure you've got a G-Mag power charger package in your hurricane supplies. If I could talk right, I could tell you what about Greenovative. Just go to Greenovative.com, Greenovative.com, and enter Hagman for a 12% discount store-wide. That's an incredible deal. Greenovative.com. Enter Hagman for a 12% discount store-wide. We're going to get back to Mr. G. Edward Griffin.
You asked a question during the...
Yeah, during the break. And this is a question we often get when we have people like yourself on. You have much experience, much knowledge. You've done a lot of analysis. In your estimation, sir... But what kind of time frame are we looking at with respect to the creation, we'll say, of a digital currency, regional currencies, and ultimately a global currency? Well, I'll just let you answer that question.
It's a really interesting question because it has a couple of layers to it. On the surface, it's simply a technical issue of how long will it take them to implement a system which they all seem to advocate. Let me strike that word seem, which they all advocate. I am not aware of any bank in the world, any spokesman for the banking system in the world, that today is not advocating that we eliminate all forms of money except the digital money. In other words, they talk about it as the cashless society. They all want that. And the reasons they give for it is, well, it would be good for you. You wouldn't lose it, for one thing. If you have money now, it might catch fire. You might lose it in a fire. It could be stolen from you. The crooks out there, you see. And also, you know, money is used for terrorism. Terrorists use paper money, and it's laundered money, and all of these things, and all these reasons they're giving are for your benefit, of course, as you're supposed to sign on to it and say, yeah, this is a good thing. But now, when you really know the banking system, as I think I do, you understand that these guys are really not philanthropists. They're not out there to make the world a better place for everybody. They're out there to make the world a better place for the banks. That's what cartels do. Whether it's a coal cartel or an oil cartel or a banana cartel or a banking cartel, the members of the cartel are interested primarily only in one thing, and that's to the benefit of the members of the cartel. So we have to keep that in mind when we hear the banks talking about all these good things for you and me that will come from a cashless society. If we look at it from their perspective, you can see that there are several strong benefits. As I mentioned before, the system that we now have is one in which every monetary transaction that goes through a bank, which is most of it, whether credit card or a check or something like that, all these transactions derive a little tiny slice, a little chip that goes to the banking system as their fee or their service. And when you add up all the financial transactions of the world, every single day, every hour, every second, this is a huge flow of revenue to the banks. There's some of that that's still outside of the banks. We were talking about that earlier, the cash, the money in the mattress, you know. Some people like to buy things with cash, and they don't report it to the government. So all of a sudden now the government says it's losing its tax revenue. So the banks and the government are most anxious to make sure that they pick up the rest of this, these transactions that are not going through the banking system and not being recorded, so that they can increase their revenue. So that's part of it. But the other part of it is that if you do not have cash and you're not allowed to hold anything outside of the banking system, then you have no way to protect your cash. If the government or the bank say, Mr. Smith, let's just take the point of view of the banks, for example, like happened in Cyprus 2 years ago. The banks in Cyprus ran out of money. They made some really bad loans. They made some bad investments. And they, like any business that makes bad investments, they lost money. And they were on the brink of going bankrupt. But unlike most businesses, which must face the consequences of their bad business decisions, the banks, because they're in partnership with the government, went to the government and said, look, you can't allow us to fail. The banks are too big to fail, too important to the nation, too important to the people. You must allow us to make up our losses by stealing the money from our depositors. Well, they didn't use the word stealing. They said remove or deduct or something. And of course, their friends in the government said, of course, that's what we must do because we must preserve the banking system. So the banks were simply able to reach into the deposit accounts of all of their customers and take huge amounts of money, millions and millions of dollars, to cover their losses, the bank's losses, and it came out of the depositors' money. And that was done legally because their partners in government passed a law that said that it was legal. If you and I were to do something like that without a law behind it, of course, we'd all go to prison. But that's what happened. Now, this is the reason that, or one of the reasons, that the banks in particular are most anxious to make sure that there is nothing outside of the banking industry in the way of money. Because if there were, and they started to do that, you and I and everybody else would say, hey, I'm not going to leave my money in the banks. I'm going to take my money and withdraw it. I'm going to put it somewhere else, even if it's in paper, and I'll put it in a mattress, or maybe I'll buy gold and silver coins, or maybe I'll buy real estate. I'll do something with it. I'm not going to leave it in the banks. So now you see the pattern why the banks are so interested in getting governments, their buddies in government, to rewrite the laws so that you will not be able to take your money out of the banks, because there will be no cash. It's all going to be in the banks, whether you like it or not. Now you have no option. If the banks are given the legal power to just take your money to cover their failures, that's what's going to happen, and you are out of luck. So that's one of the primary motives for the cashless society today. And just forget all this nonsense about protecting the nation against terrorism or all of this other stuff. It's to protect the banks so that they will have access to money from depositors in the event that their business decisions run sour. Now, on the other side, the government is perfectly willing to do this because now if the government decides that you've done something wrong and they want to fine you for something and you say, gee, I don't have any money. Well, maybe you do and maybe you don't in the present system. Maybe you have your money outside of the banks. Maybe you have your money somewhere that nobody knows about. And you're telling the government you don't have any money. But if you have no other place to put it, if it all has to be in the banks by law, now the government says, well, okay, you may not have enough money. We're going to fine you $85,000 for this trespass that you did, whatever it is. And we see you have $52,000 in your bank. Thank you very much. You still owe us the balance, but we got the $52,000 and you've got nothing but a receipt. That's the reason the government wants to do it, because now it's not a question of having to depend on you to send your check to the government for your taxes or your fees or your penalties. You don't pay your taxes anymore. They just come and take it because it's in the bank, and the government has a right to take it out of the bank even before you do. This is what's behind the cashless society today. It's all about denying you the access to to your own property, which is represented by money. Now, back to the question, how soon are we to that? I don't really know. I don't think anybody knows, but it's clear to me from the speeches that are being given and the conferences that are being held at the international level on this issue that the people who are making this proposal, by the way, they've already started it. You might have noticed that in some countries, big bills are taken out of circulation. You're only allowed to use small bills. They're talking about that in the United States right now. They want to get rid of even the $100 bill, so you have to use $20 bills and so forth. The process has started, and it seems to me that they have about a 5 or 10 year timeline in their minds. Will that happen? I don't know. I think that depends entirely on the pushback that people like you and me and people watching this program, if they finally understand what's really going on, it may become very politically unpopular for elected representatives to support this movement. So I think it depends a lot on how much awakening takes place. And then finally, that leads to the deeper question, the lower level, is that often I hear people say, well, how much time do you think we have left before the new world order is upon us? You know, they keep talking about the new world order is a phrase not invented by people like me, not invented by people who are critical of it, but invented by people who are advocates of it. You know, the real global elitists, that they've been using the word or the phrase the new world order for many decades to describe this wonderful world government based on the model of collectivism that they have in mind. It's wonderful to them, not to me. And so the question is, well, when is the new world order likely to occur? And my answer is, wake up, everybody. It's here. It's already here. It's not a question of someday it'll happen. They're not going to ring a bell at noon on the 4th of September or something like that. It's already here. It's just a question of how extensive is it. Day by day, it is. The walls are being built brick by brick. The walls are getting higher and higher, and your freedom to maneuver is getting more and more limited. It's here now. It's not complete, but it's well under construction. We still have time to reverse that process. But ladies and gentlemen, we are running out of time rapidly, and that's one of the things we'll be talking about at the Red Pill Expo.
And, you know, Mr. Griffin, you laid it out perfectly, the, you know, the consolidation of wealth that the masterminds of this new world order are behind, but also the control. And I believe that, as you said, you know, quoting Rockefeller and others, that there is no amount of wealth that these people will attain and say, all right, I've done it, you know, we can stop going after it. But I believe that, you know, the wealth is secondary to the control, especially since we are in, you know, the last days of this economic system. And I kind of wanted to go over to what we see with the stock market, what we see with gold and silver, and just with the stock market first. We see it breaking records, you know, 21,000, 20,000, 21,000. And we also see, as you pointed out in the first segment, about the loss of the value of the dollar that it's had over the last 104 years. Is the high numbers and high value of the stock market directly related to the inflation, or is there another driver behind this?
I believe that it's related to both. I think inflation, of course, if the dollar's purchasing power is going down, let's say it's gone down 97% since the Federal Reserve was created, obviously, if you're going to measure the stock market value in terms of dollars, that means that even though it may appear that the value of the stock market has held perfectly the same, it's actually lost 97% of its true value. So that element is certainly in place, but there's another element which I think is even more important, and that is that the stock market and all markets to one extent or another today are no longer free markets. We no longer live in a classic capitalist system, which by proper definition involves a free market of free enterprise competition. That has to be part of any realistic definition of capitalism. Let me digress just for a moment. If you want to make a distinction on that, and I think it's probably a good idea to do so, we should look at capitalism as its classical form, which is free enterprise capitalism, and then its artificial form that we see today, which is monopoly capitalism. They're two different animals. I don't really consider monopoly capitalism to be capitalism at all, but somehow those words have been thrust upon it. So if you're going to insist on calling the present system a capitalist system, then I will insist that we identify that it's not a free market capitalist system, but a monopoly capitalist system that is reinforced and supported by government edict, which means simply that the free market doesn't exist under the present system. So I don't know where I was going with that, really, except that the value of a stock market in a controlled system like that is almost meaningless, because it's not derived by the traditional forces of supply and demand. If it were, I think the value of the stock market today, if there were no hidden forces trying to manipulate the stock market, and I'll come back to that perhaps in a moment, if it were a truly free market operating in the stock market arena, I think the value of stocks would have plummeted. And it's only up seemingly high because the Federal Reserve is allocating tremendous amounts of money and credit to certain elements within the market to buy up stocks artificially, pay artificially high prices for them to keep the value apparently high. And I don't really know the details. This is very secret, but I do know that something like this is going on, that the buyers of the stocks in the market are being assured in some way that they cannot lose. They're being told, you buy this pitiful piece of stock here. We know it's worth garbage, but you buy it anyway and pay more money for it than it's worth. And we guarantee you, you won't lose on it. We'll make sure that you make it up in some other way. We'll give you credits. We'll give you loans at lower than market interest rates, or we'll cover you, in other words. And so with that kind of behind-the-scenes manipulation, we see that happening in the banking industry all the time, manipulation of markets. That pushes the apparent value of the stock market up, but it's a false number. It's not real. And so for those that want to speculate in the market, it's not a bad deal. I mean, you speculate. We all know that. Remember the old days? It was over two centuries ago. The episode of tulipomania. There were people in Holland that were buying and selling tulip bulbs because they were rare. That, oh, these are more valuable than any other tulip bulbs you've ever seen. These have a blue stripe on the side, and that's a new one. And people were selling their houses and, I mean, borrowing money on their houses so they could buy tulip bulbs. They buy them one day at $50 a piece and sell them the next day at $200 a piece, reinvest those and sell them the next day for $400 a piece, the next day for $1,000 a piece, and people were making fortunes until the day finally came when somehow there was a signal, everybody got the message that these are just tulip bulbs, guys. That's all they are. And nobody wanted to pay anything for them. And, of course, that's when the bubble burst and we got back to reality. People were wiped out, except those that just fortunately got out of the market at the right time. There are always a few of those that do that. So now back to your question. The stock market today is completely very much like tulipomania. The value of the market is not inherent in the stock market price. The only reason the price is high is because it's being artificially supported by the Federal Reserve and that group of bankers who want to keep it high, partly to keep the people of the world thinking, oh, well, you know, the economy is good. Look, the stock market is up. Even though they're out of a job, even though prices are through the roof, even though everything is stinking to high heaven, even though there are 10 cities, oh, look, the stock market is up, so everything is okay. That's part of the reason behind it. So the bottom line then is, if you're a speculator and you want to play that market, you probably can make some money by being in the market while it's going up, but be very sensitive to getting out at the right time, and nobody really knows that unless you're an insider and you have information that the average person does not have. In my case, I'm not in the stock market because I think it's corrupt. I don't want to play with corrupt players that own the game.
What about gold and silver? For example, you said you're not in the stock market because it's corrupt. Gold and silver prices are being manipulated as well.
And Bitcoin, too, if we can throw that in there. Bitcoin reached, I saw last week it was at 2,000 per Bitcoin. Now it's at 2,400. But, yeah, we can deal with gold and silver.
Yeah, I was just curious. What do you feel about that?
I like gold and silver because it's real money. One of the attributes of a good money is that it has value of its own, even if it were not used for money. It's important to know that there are certain attributes that make certain things better for money than others. I mean, traditionally and historically, a lot of things have been used for money. In the beginning, it was jars of wheat. Well, now wheat is useful, whether you use it for money or not. That's the reason they started to use it for money, is because it did have intrinsic value. Later on, it was cattle. If you had a few extra cows that you needed, you could trade a cow, and that was early form of money. It had intrinsic value. So any good money should have intrinsic value, which is one of the reasons that gold and silver has always throughout history risen to the top of the list of what cultures and societies instinctively choose as money. It's not because some wise group committee said this is what you should use as money. It's not because the government said this is what you shall use as money. It's because people chose to use it because it had intrinsic value. So now we come to that's the value of gold and silver. That's why I like it. Even when the stock market collapses, or I should say especially when or if the stock market collapses, gold and silver will have intrinsic value. You don't have to say what are the dividends that this piece of stock is going to pay, and now that the company's gone out of business, hey, it's gold or silver. It can be used for making jewelry. It's used in industry and so forth. It has intrinsic value. So that's why I like gold and silver. I don't look at gold and silver as an investment. I think an investment by proper definition would be putting your money into some activity or venture that will generate income. Gold and silver don't do that. They just lie in a drawer or in a vault. They don't produce income. So they're not really an investment. But I look at it as a savings. It's a means of protecting your wealth. If you have any or whatever you have, you protect its value. Because no matter whether the price of everything else goes up or down, the price of gold and silver goes up and down more or less with it. So if everything drops and all the prices go down, surely gold and silver will go down too, but it'll always maintain its purchasing power relative to everything else. So I like gold and silver for a lot of reasons. I think it's going to be around a lot longer than any fiat money. In fact, we know historically fiat money never lasts. There's not one that you can think of that has lasted more than a couple of hundred years. So why should we think that that rule has changed now?
No, you're absolutely right. Mr. Griffin, we only have about 2 minutes left. Final thoughts on Bitcoin. I don't know how much you have looked into Bitcoin, but it seems to be gaining tremendous increases in value just in the last few weeks and months. Any thoughts about
that? I like Bitcoin because it causes people to look critically at the present fiat money system, which they haven't done. They've just accepted that whatever money that governments tell us we have to use has got to be good money. Now we can compare that assumption to something like Bitcoin, which is at present, at least, beyond the reach of governments. And we can see that its value is going up. Well, why is its value going up? It's going up because it's a new currency, and anything that's new tends to have a little jump if it's popular. It rises faster than its true value would otherwise push it up. So it's in that honeymoon stage. That's part of it. The other part of it is because people think, well, look, it's gone up 1,000% now or whatever it is, then it's going to continue to go up 1,000% and maybe another 1,000%. So I want to jump into it and make some money on it. So it becomes a speculation. It's not really money anymore. Right now, I think the driving force behind Bitcoin is as a speculation, because people are not buying it so they can use it as a medium of exchange and buy clothes and gasoline or whatever with it. They're buying it because they think they're going to make a killing on it. So they're speculators. Now, that won't last. It never lasts forever. Someday, the true value of the Bitcoin will come down, and the speculation aspect will be stripped out of it, and we'll see what its true value will be in a free market economy. It's, you know, what the bartering power is. It'll be a lot less than what it is now. But meanwhile, there's a big ride going up, and so if people want to speculate some money, I think, go for it. But don't bet the farm on it, because those things are very cyclical, they're very uncertain, they're, you know, they're volatile is what they like to say. And one last thing on Bitcoin is, remember, Bitcoin has no intrinsic value. We're talking about gold and silver having intrinsic. When Bitcoin is gone, notice I said when, not if.
Mm-hmm.
When Bitcoin is gone, what is left? Well, that, it's gone. That's it. It has no intrinsic value. If the internet goes down, let's say we're talking about, you know, something happening to the internet. Maybe it's an EMP attack. Maybe it's a solar flare and the grid goes down for a month or a year. Where's your Bitcoin? Well, you can't eat it. You can't hand it to somebody. So Bitcoin is missing that one element of having intrinsic value. There are people today talking about ways to overcome that, to tie Bitcoin or some other cryptocurrency to gold or silver. If they can accomplish that, I think it would be a great improvement and would overcome that one downside.
Well, I'll tell you what. Thank you, Mr. Griffin. We're up against the top of the hour network break. You've been so generous with your time. People can get your book, and I highly recommend it, The Creature from Jekyll Island. Of course, see you at the Red Pill Expo.
RedPillExpo.org.
Yep.
Postman or bust.
God bless you, my friend.
Have a great evening, we'll see Mr. Griffin. Thanks for joining the show.
Thank you.
Folks, we'll be right back with Pastor David Langford. Don't go anywhere.
CERN actually discovered the God particle. In As the Darkness Falls, Daniel wrote about an Islamist terrorist confederacy that rose up out of Syria and declared a caliphate 3 years before ISIS was ever heard of. In his newest novel, Between the Veil, Daniel talks about a space between dimensions where supernatural beings can walk. He says that these novels are a warning from the Creator to his creation. Will war come to America? Will the world's economies collapse? Are we looking at increased earthquakes and volcanic activity? Will the United States fall into civil war? You can find all of Daniel's work at his website, danielholdings.com. That's danielholdings.com. All of these things and more are talked about in Daniel's books. To find out what's coming next, go to danielholdings.com.
Worldwide demand is making coconuts one of the highest-yielding cash crops available today. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and many high-net-worth individuals have invested billions of dollars into coconuts for strong growth and solid long-term income. Yields could be as high as 18% or more per year. Capital appreciation and exceptional income for up to 60 long years would be an absolutely brilliant investment to pass on to future generations. Diversify wisely with direct ownership of fully managed coconuts on prime farmland close to the beautiful Costa Rican border. For more information, qualified accredited investors should go to profitsincoconuts.com or phone 855-888-6288. That's 855-888-6288. This announcement does not constitute an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offer made by prospectus only. 855-888-6288 or visit profitsincoconuts.com. Profitsincoconuts.com.
You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes a secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in his community and beyond. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.